across the lake instead of at Urbane. Delayed permission, and only for a few hours, actually. Only until we've had a chance to talk together. Talk together? Talk about what? Everly turned back toward the scientist, then seemed to look past his shoulder. Urbane got the impression that the man was searching the area to make certain that no one was close enough to overhear them. My people tell me that it's a violation of the safety rules to launch all the satellites we have in store and leave nothing in reserve, in case of an emergency. That is why I asked for the personnel and materials to build an additional dozen satellites, Urbane snapped. Yes, I know. And your people have been dragging their feet on my request. Regrettable, murmured Everly. Urbane stopped walking and crossed his arms over his chest. What is this all about? He demanded. Why are you opposing me? Everly turned to face him, his usual smile gone, his face cold and hard. You want to launch your satellites into orbit around Titan and build another dozen to serve as backups, Urbane interjected. Yes, said Everly. And I want to mine Saturn's rings. Urbane blinked with surprise. Mine the rings? For ice. Water ice. It's the most precious commodity in the solar system. I know, muttered Urbane, remembering that Everly had used the idea of mining Saturn's rings as a ploy during the election campaign. He held out to the habitat citizens the glittering promise of becoming wealthy by selling water ice to other human communities in space. You and the other scientists oppose the idea, Everly said, especially that Wonderly person. She discovered indigenous life forms in the rings, Urbane said, more to himself than to Everly. I'm told that most of the scientists back on Earth don't believe her claim. Nonetheless, the mere possibility that living organisms may exist in the rings means that all commercial activities are forbidden. The ICU hasn't issued any prohibition, said Everly. Neither has the IAA. The International Consortium of Universities has asked for my estimation of the matter before they make a recommendation to the International Astronautical Authority. I thought as much. Now I understand, Urbane said. You want me to recommend to the ICU that you should be allowed to mine the rings. We wouldn't make a dent in them. There's gazillions of tons of ice in those rings. We would only take a minuscule fraction of it. Urbane glowered at Everly with undisguised revulsion. You want to blackmail me. You will withhold permission to launch my satellites unless I allow you to mine the rings. Everly smiled thinly. That isn't blackmail. The correct word is extortion. Nevertheless, if you want to get those satellites down to Titan, where they can search for your wandering probe, you'll have to tell the ICU that it's perfectly all right for us to mine the rings. Urbane could see from the hard set of Everly's jaw that he had no third option.
8 January 2096, morning. Malcolm Everly did not sleep well that night. He awoke slowly, feeling dull and aching as he did those mornings when he had been in prison in Austria. The vague memory of a bad dream haunted him. The more he tried to remember its specifics, the more the details slipped away from him, leaving only a dark sense of dread. Why? He asked himself. You have nothing to be afraid of. The holy disciples can't reach you anymore. They can't send you back to prison. You're safe here. The people of this habitat respect and admire you. But do they? That was what troubled him, he realized. They could vote me out of office in a few months, and then where would I be? I'd have to find an ordinary job and live on an ordinary wage. That was what had troubled his sleep, Everly decided. The re-election campaign. He had won the election in the first place on the promise that Goddard's inhabitants would get rich from mining the rings of Saturn. The scientists, led by Urbane, had opposed the idea, of course, but the voters had supported it wholeheartedly. Now it was almost time to register candidates for the next election, and Everly knew he had done nothing about mining the rings. He allowed the idea to fall into hibernation while he set up the new government and got it running with a modicum of efficiency. But now the voters would remember that promise of wealth and demand that Eberle make good on it. And still the scientists opposed him. They were backed by the powers that be on Earth. "My re-election is not assured," Eberle told himself. "Urbain won't run against me, and I'm sure that I've neutralized Tymoshenko. But someone will stand up to oppose me. Who?" As he brushed his teeth, showered, shaved, and dressed for the day's work, his mind kept coming back to the inevitable answer. Pancho Lane. She didn't come to this habitat merely to see her sister. She coyly refuses to tell anyone how long she intends to stay. Within the week, she'll apply for citizenship and then register as a candidate to oppose me. "What can I do to stop her?" Eberle asked himself as he walked through the morning sunlight to his office and the light breakfast his aide would have waiting for him. "How can I get rid of Pancho Lane?" He lightly touched the spot on his jaw where Pancho had hit him. "How can I make her pay for that humiliation?"
Urbain, meanwhile, was having breakfast with his wife in his own apartment. "He will bribe the voters with visions of vast wealth," he grumbled, as he sipped his stinging hot coffee. Jean-Marie was the only woman in the world who knew how to make coffee strong enough to be palatable. He had missed her coffee during the years of their separation. "But the ICU is on record as being against mining Saturn's rings," Jean-Marie said from across their narrow kitchen table. "It means nothing," Urbain scoffed. "What can they do? How can they enforce their position? Send an army of bureaucrats here?"
Jean-Marie almost smiled at the thought of a horde of university file surfers descending on the habitat. "Eberle could refuse them permission to dock," Urbain went on. "He could send them packing back to Earth." His wife brought her cup to her lips. She preferred tea with lemon. "But couldn't the ICU ask the International Astronautical Authority to enforce their decision? The IAA is not to be trifled with." Urbain gave his wife a condescending look. "My dear, it has been little more than a year since the second asteroid war was ended. Do you believe that the IAA or anyone on Earth will be willing to start another war?" "A war?" Jean-Marie looked stricken. "Do you really think that Eberle would use force against the IAA?" "I believe the man will do whatever he feels necessary to maintain his position as leader of this habitat." "But war?" He shrugged. "Spacecraft are very fragile. A laser shot could disable an IAA ship as it approaches us, perhaps even destroy it." Jean-Marie shook her head. "He wouldn't dare." "Cellini declared its independence and then fought off an attempt by the old United Nations to subdue them. The miners at Ceres have established their independence. Why not Habitat Goddard? After all, we are much farther away than any other human habitation. What do the people of Earth care about what we do?" "They care about mining Saturn's rings, do they not?" "Yes, some of them. But the people living on the moon and among the asteroids would be in favor of having an abundant supply of water made available to them."
"For a price," Jean-Marie pointed out.
Urbain stared at her. Then he countered, "Eberle is very clever, wily. He will keep the price low enough for them to want to buy, and still high enough to bring wealth to Goddard." She started to reply, but he got up from their tiny kitchen table, clearly signaling that their conversation was at an end. Jean-Marie sat there, clasping her delicate cup of cooling tea in both hands. It had been her mother's tea set. No, she remembered, her grandmother's. Urbain came back to the kitchen, fumbling with the ascot he had slid around his neck. Jean-Marie knew he expected her to knot it for him, yet she did not get up from her chair. "Is this business of mining the rings so important?" she asked. "Will it do irreparable harm to the rings?" "In time," Urbain said, looking into the mirror behind his wife as he worked on tying the ascot. "The real problem is that he will not lift a finger to help me unless I support his proposal of mining the ice." She saw the expression on his face. utter distaste and, beneath it all, the fear of failure.